Hey, Colette, what's going on?
Racking them and stacking them. How about you?
Well, as always, I am living the dream.
Well, what will it be?
Oh, what am I feeling like today? Well, hey, anything on special?
Well, there's always the Tiki Love Bowl, but I have to set it on fire before I serve it to you, and that's kind of a nice tie.
Yeah, let's stay away from open flames today. I'll just have the usual.
Sounds good. Hey, hold on one second. Another customer just walked in. Hey, how are you? What will it be today? Who, that guy? That's David! Well, as we know him, D. Fish. He's sort of an all-purpose business talker. Yep, speaking, writing, podcasts, training. He is always talking to somebody about business or music or beer. You never know which way it's gonna go, but it's always interesting. In fact, why don't I grab your drink and you go over there and join them?
Hey there! Welcome to another episode of Beer, Beats, and Business. I'm glad that you could join us for another round of interesting conversations with interesting people. My guest today is Rebecca Burnick. Rebecca has been a friend of mine for years, and she is the founder and big head of Office Heads. They provide financial management and strategic coaching to small creative and professional service firms. Here's a little bit of what we chatted about.
Find your passion and then figure out how to make money doing it, because then every day is a lot of fun.
As I said, I've known Rebecca for years, and we've been on the entrepreneurial journey together during that time. I was fired up to have her on the show for two reasons. One, she's super smart, and I knew she'd have some great insights into how to be a more successful and effective business owner. But number two, Rebecca always has great stories. She's done so many fascinating things during her life, and I knew that we'd touch on a couple of them. And you know what? I wasn't disappointed. My name is David J.P. Fisher, but everyone just calls me D. Fish. And I have a lot of different jobs, but my most important job today is to be your host on Beer, Beats, and Business. So let's get to it. Rebecca, how are you today?
I'm great. I'm great. How are you?
Oh, as always, I am living the dream.
Oh.
It's a great dream.
Why,
yeah, exactly. Why not? Why not? So excited to have you on the show. And just so I can get all of the guilt off of my shoulders, thank you for being on the show again. You were, it's every podcaster's nightmare. You were the interview that I forgot to push record. We had a great conversation, didn't capture any of it, but you were nice enough to come back. Thank you so much.
Well, it'll be, I'm curious to see if my answers have changed since then, but you know, my pleasure to for a take two.
Maybe I did it on purpose. Maybe I should give everyone a dress rehearsal, right? Here's my question for you to start off the show. Why do most entrepreneurs and small business owners completely avoid looking at the financial aspects of their business?
Well, everyone is different, but I would say in my experiences, it's because people go into business because they're passionate about something. And 9 times out of 10, it is not for the financial aspects. You go into business because you have a product that you love or a service that you love or a mission that just speaks to who you are. And you, so you just jump in and you absolutely love it. And it isn't until, you know, a few months or a few years that go by when you go, oh, wait a minute, I have to file taxes and I have to invoice people, and you kind of forget. I think that also combined with people just don't like math. And
okay.
The fear of like third grade math, you start talking about numbers and they just, I don't want to think about it. So it's usually the combination of both those two things.
Gotcha. I remember, when I was in college, I took an accounting class, and it was the first time we did, like, I forget what they're called, like T charts or whatever, where, you know, basic accounting. Mm-hmm. And I remember going home to my, and talking to my mom that weekend. I was like, I actually like math, Mom, as long as there's a dollar sign in front of it. It makes total sense. This calculus stuff is garbage. What is it that, people are, is it just that they don't like the math, or do you think there's also something about not wanting to look at kind of the money aspects? Because I you said passion there, and I think a lot of times people don't like putting together passion and money, right?
Well, I did. I love doing what I do, and then there's money into it. I think it's because there's also another aspect to it, which is when you are, especially if you're in a startup mode, but if you are a solopreneur, lifestyle business, or even, you know, at any stage of your business, you're busy. There's no free time in the day. And you got to look at your big old list. And you're going to go, oh, what am I going to do? It's one of those things that you say, I'll get to it later. I'll get to it later, because there's other things that you either want to do or have to do.
Well, right. And you just said it there, like the other things you want to do, right? It's that thing that always goes to like number seven on the list every day.
Well, and it's funny. Let's do a flip flop of that, because I love doing numbers and I love looking at the math and running and number crunching. But if I have write a blog, it's something I have to do is write a blog today. I won't write blogs for 3 months because like, oh, that's so hard for me to do. I can do math all day long and strategize and make plans and build processes all day long. Writing, I have plenty to say, but writing a blog is just, it's hard. It's hard.
So basically, to extrapolate from that, the things that we find are hard, we push off, no surprise there. And you're just a little odd that you love the numbers and you love the processes. Whereas most people go into the business, as I said, they're passionate about something that's not numbers driven. And so the stuff they don't like doing is, as you said, sitting down with that spreadsheet and going, oh, I gotta figure this out to pay taxes this quarter. It just never happens, right?
Right. Or there are other questions. They've been in business for a couple of years and they say, oh, I don't even know what I can pay myself. What should I be able to pay myself? Or I need help because I can't do this myself. I need to hire someone. Can I afford it? What is my cash flow? I want to move from my kitchen table to a co-working space or a co-working space to a new brand new facility. Can I afford it? How am I going to do this? So it isn't really until there's this major, a lot of times it can happen for different reasons, but usually when there's this major growth phase or you're trying to jump from startup to, you know, growth and trying to delegate and put these into place where you need to, that you have the questions that can be answered with the numbers.
Well, and that's, you're just explaining this and I just am loving the irony. Because I've experienced this with my own clients. I know you've probably come into this a lot where people are like, I need to hire somebody to help me figure out my numbers, but I don't know if I can afford to hire somebody to figure out my numbers because I haven't figured out my numbers.
Yeah. Well, you know, yes, that happens a lot. And that's where you have to say, well, then this would be an investment. So regardless if it's painful enough or important enough, then you've got to figure out a way to prioritize those things. Because, you know, the way that we work, yes, we're a bookkeeping and an accounting firm, but I like to call ourselves an accountability firm. So we keep people accountable for what they're trying to accomplish. And I like to say that we grow small businesses because it's not just about the bookkeeping and accounting. It's what are you trying to accomplish? And how can we get you from 500K to a million? And is it going to be marketing? And is there a budget for that? And you need people to help. And we just ask all these wonderful, great questions. And then if you have a plan to say, well, now I know the numbers behind the activity that I need to do to get there, all you need to do is get there. And so we actually build those small businesses. So it's an investment. It's the same thing with what you do too. It's an investment in changing behaviors or having more knowledge to be able to get to the bigger picture and the ultimate goal.
Absolutely. Now, so let me ask, if you were talking to somebody, you know, somebody's listening right now, let's say, and they're, you know, in a startup phase or, you know, they're an entrepreneur, they own a small business, maybe they don't, maybe they've thought about it. What's the way that you think people can get themselves to make that investment? Because I am with you 100% that there has to be this mentality of investing and there's almost like some faith and some trust involved in that. But that's scary. That can be hard to do. Like, what would you suggest to somebody to help them get to that point or maybe even past that point?
Oh, that's a really good question. I would say, I think there's a time when you know it's right. Because I know that when I first started Office Ads back in 2008, that I wish I could have things, but I knew I couldn't do it. And I just had to put in sweat equity and time to be able to get things done. But there is a time when you go, okay, wait a minute. I have proven that my service or my product is worthy and valid because there's people out there buying it. And I know that if I do certain things, I'm not quite sure what those things are, that I know I can increase revenue, but I can't continue to do what I'm doing now. I think it's that special tipping point where you know you've got something.
Okay.
And if you're not there yet, where you go, it's just painful, or life is hard, or I don't want to do this anymore, but you don't see that there's change around the corner, maybe it's not time to make that investment.
Gotcha. Well, and maybe it's this idea of taking, you talked about discomfort or something's painful. Maybe it's about taking a little time to figure out why it's painful.
Right.
You know, is it a matter of being painful because you should grow, like you should outsource this or you should delegate this. Or as you said, sometimes it's, this is painful. It's not worth hiring somebody to do this, but it needs to get done. So guess what? I'm going to, you know, buckle down and actually do it.
Right. Well, you know, sometimes the truth hurts.
I was going to say, and sometimes it also hurts that there's no one size fits all easy answers to this, right?
Right.
It's not a checklist.
Right. We've got a metric at Office Heads that it allows me to sleep well at night. It's Office Heads services needs to be 3% of your revenue or less for us to be a good value. So if somebody comes in and says, I need you to do all these things for me, but I'm only pulling in $50,000 a year, I'll look at, you know, what is it going to cost to do this, this, and this, and blah, blah, blah. And it's you know, the numbers are skewed. I will say, you know, it's not the right time. Your dollars need to be put somewhere else to be able to build your revenue and your business a little bit more before it is actually a value to bring us on the team. I love the entrepreneurial spirit. I love all of that. And it's so hard to say, I'm sorry, you're not ready for Office Heads, because we're kind of a juicy package. You know, we're not just bookkeeping. We build processes and do coaching. It's a lot more. And if you're just not ready, then it's like, oh, well, we can teach you how to do things the Office Heads way, which is still an investment.
Right. What I actually love about what you said is it isn't necessarily just about creating value for your end client, although that's part of it. The little thing you said there, it lets us sleep at night, right? Because it lets you know, hey, this is how we're going to provide value versus just take somebody for what they're worth, right? If somebody's not ready for us, but they'll pay us, well, hey, that's too bad on them.
Well, no, that's silly.
Right?
Because if my end game is to grow small businesses, how are they going to grow if their money's going to me and it really shouldn't be?
Mm.
If I want a long-term relationship with a company and watch their revenue double year after year and watch an entrepreneur start to delegate and build processes and actually wear the CEO hat, because, you know, this is one of the things that I educate my clients of, you know, when you started your business, you actually took on the job of CEO. You just didn't know it yet. And so if you've gotten to a certain point where you don't have to be the bookkeeper anymore, you don't have to be the marketer anymore, you don't have to, you know, take out your own trash, you don't, if you start to grow your company and delegate and build a foundation to scale, at the end of the day, you should just be strategic and staying out of the weeds. And that's my job, is to pull them out of doing the work to be more strategic and be the CEO that they signed on to be from day one.
Love it. You're there for the long haul. Even if that doesn't mean the client's a client today, they might be in 6 months or a year, and you're going to be there for them.
Exactly.
What a weird concept.
Is it?
I don't think it's a weird concept, but let's face it. Unfortunately, it's a little more rare these days than maybe we'd like, right?
Yeah.
Now, how did you get to this point? And I'm asking this question partly because I'm curious and partly because I want you to share with the listener, because back when you started, I was there, right? We've kind of grown our businesses together, which is fantastic. And we've known each other, gosh, now for about 10 years since we started our companies. How did Office Heads get to, I mean, you've shared all these things you're doing. You're, you know, more than just accounting. You're talking about processes and coaching and really helping small businesses create that foundation for a healthy, long-term life. How did you get to that point? Like, how did you get here?
Well, it's funny because I woke up one day and went, wait a minute, I have an accounting firm. How did I get an accounting firm? I am not your I didn't go up the ranks of being a classical accountant or CPA. I spent 15 years as the business manager of a strategic management consulting firm. And they were founded here in Evanston. We moved downtown after a period of time. And 15 years later, after I built all the processes, and I was basically an entrepreneur with somebody else's money. And so we went from four people up to 16 and then down to 10. And then we were kind of back and forth and back and forth. There was always a process or new computers or hiring, and just there was always something to do to make it more efficient and run like a top. And it was a consulting firm. So, you know, my job, I basically said, listen, consultants, you have the responsibility, two jobs, to go and consult and to hand in your timesheet so I can do billing. And other than that, I can handle the rest. And, you know, if they did both of those things, then the company grew, and it did. So after 15 years, I just basically, you know, the quintessential worked myself out of a job because everything was running smoothly. There was nothing more for me to do. So I left their employ and I said, okay, I'm going to do for other companies what I did for them. And I started asking my prospects if there was something that drove you crazy about your business, that if you got rid of it, you could get back to what you were passionate about. 99.9% of the time they said, oh my God, do you do QuickBooks? So I became a bookkeeper, but that wasn't, you know, I had strategies, you know, seeping out of my pores. So it wasn't just about paying the bills and making sure the money came in. Right. It was about, okay, let's do this efficiently. And then what are you going to do with it? How are you going to grow? What are you going to do? What are your customers saying? I just would ask all these interesting questions because I was curious. And before you know it, I was consulting and growing small businesses. So that was back in 2008. And so here we are now in 2017. And I'm, this is what we do now. We focus more on the strategic business planning piece, but we use the numbers to tell the story to help you grow.
Well, one thing I've always loved about your approach is that you really do look at that strategy piece as well as the tactics, right? It's not one or the other. It's kind of how they're related.
Absolutely. Yep.
And so you've said this a couple of times already, this idea of growing small businesses and building small businesses. Obviously you are, you've also said passion like more times, I think, than any other guest has said it on the show. You know, I know small business is something you're passionate about. One of the things that you got involved with was the Goldman Sachs 10,000 Small Businesses program, right?
Yes, I did.
So tell me about that, because I love small business too, but what came out of that? What were some of the big takeaways that you learned? What are we still working on as a community of small business people that maybe we need to still put more focus on?
Well, you know, it was a phenomenal program. It was a lot of work and a lot of time. And for me, it was the right time. And because I do small business planning and know my numbers, I knew a lot of the stuff already. I walked in, and especially the numbers piece, most of the people were scared of the finance piece. I'm like, this is the best part. I have a 1-year plan. I have a 5-year plan. I have a 10-year plan. And the path is somewhat was prior to the program somewhat broad. The Goldman Sachs 10,000 Small Businesses program gave me more of a laser focus. Mm. The ultimate goal was to have a growth plan, which is different than a business plan. It was a growth plan to say, what am I going to do to increase my revenue, create new jobs? And ultimately, it gave me also the thinking of what's my exit strategy. And if you take a look at the small businesses that I work with, and typically mine are the entrepreneurs trying to take that leap from startup to growth. You know, again, you're looking down and you're working so hard that you forget that the reason you start your business is to sell or to exit sometime. And so the program reminded me of that it's okay to think about where this is going. And it gave me more of a laser focus. So my wide path, my 1-year, 5-year, 10-year became pretty clear on what I needed to do to take it to that next level.
So it sounds like a good thing that maybe even you're bringing to your clients then is this idea of not having a 1, 5, or 10-year plan just to have it, but even going to the last, you know, almost having them imagine what it, the last day that you do this job, what does that mean? Is that because you retired? Is that because you sold it? Is, you know, what was that exit or succession plan? And then work backwards, right? And go, well, okay, if that's going to happen in 20 years,
what do you do today?
What do you do today to get there?
Exactly. And so then we become, and I take a lot of what I learned at that program and apply it to my workings with my clients, because it's, you know, you can daydream or plan or think or jot things down on a piece of paper, but until you put these into actionable, timely goals and objectives to be able to do it, and then hold yourself accountable or have someone to hold you accountable, mm-hmm. then that's when things happen. And again, that's what I love to do. It's helping that CEO in training to go, oh, I never thought about my business that way before. And so then you come up with like financial models and things and say, well, if you did this and then change that, then you can get to this goal faster. And do you think you can do that? And does that fit with your goal, with your heart? You know, because you went into business not because of what I think you should do, but what you want to do.
Right.
And people walk out of my office going, oh, I feel so empowered and inspired. And I only have to do these five things over the next 3 months.
Gotcha. Well, you're right on. I mean, something I've told people for years is goals, like long-term goals in and of themselves are kind of pointless. It's to the degree that you can take those long-term goals and go, how does it inform what I'm doing right now in this moment, that they have value, right?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And you know, I'm guilty of this, and I try to make sure that my clients don't forget to celebrate more often. Because when you have a goal and then you meet that goal, instead of going, great, I got the next one, and what have you, if you take your, again, you have these long-term goals and you break it up into quarterly chunks or even monthly chunks, that you can say, I'm going to do this in the next 3 weeks, or I'm going to do this by the end of next month, or at least until Rebecca calls me and asks me if I've done it.
And then, right.
And then we can celebrate and go, I actually did that. And that one was hard for me.
I was just reading an article about exactly this topic the other day. And it was interesting because they talked about the idea of having a to-done list versus a to-do list. And the idea at the end of the day, and this was, I think, very much about people who are, whether they're entrepreneurs or business owners or salespeople, people who are goal-driven and, you know, sometimes very ambitious and have drive. And I know it happens for me. I know it's happened to you because you share this before, where like you get to the end of the day and you don't feel you've done anything, but not because you haven't done anything. It's just, you've done so much, but none of it seems big enough. And the idea was having a to-done list where you'd be like, hey, made movement on that project, called that client, you know, secured that business. And you can realize all these little places to celebrate.
Yeah.
Instead of waiting for, you know, in 10 years when I sell the company, then I'll celebrate.
Yep.
All right.
Now you gotta sell it, because this is hard work. We're passionate about, if we weren't passionate about our businesses, we would have quit a long time ago, because this is the job. This job is too hard to handle, and you would quit. So you have to have a passion around it. And so as long as you're passionate, you're just doing all the hard work to move it forward, you might as well stop every once in a while and go, look what I've done. And at least like take 15 seconds.
Absolutely. Right. I mean, it always surprises me. And I think both you and I have fallen in this trap before where, you know, we almost poo-poo some of the successes we've had, and other people be like, oh my gosh, you've run your own business for, you know, 10 years. You've had this accomplishment or that accomplishment. And you're just like, yeah, whatever, but it's not my end goal. So it's not valuable.
Exactly.
And sometimes you have to remind yourself, wait, hold on a second. I mean, it's funny. I was talking with my mother-in-law, who was asking me about having a cake for my next book release. And my first book, and the reason I bring the story up is my first book that I ever published, we had the celebration, the launch party at your office, at Office Heads. Thank you very much. Yeah. And my mother-in-law is an amazing, amazing baker, runs a bakery here in the Chicago area. And so we had a cake that looked like a book. It was awesome. And I remember at that point going, oh yeah, I was celebrating. And you know, now I've written 7 books. I'm like, yeah, whatever, probably not. And I just realized as we're speaking, I should probably have a cake.
Well, okay, you're going to celebrate with a cake, and then allow me to jump in and celebrate because I have moved offices since then and I've got a much bigger space. And so if you want to celebrate at Office Heads again at Office Heads, you know, expanded space, it could even be better and we can celebrate together.
Well, I think that there's an offline conversation that's going to happen. I like this. If this is not proving to the listener of the show that business can happen in any conversation, there's always opportunities. Rebecca, you've just proven my point. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
All right. So I want to talk about passion for a second. And I want to talk about a passion that you have. And I want you to tell us about a world record that you hold. But before I do that, I want to do our station identification and let everybody know that they are listening to the Beer Beats and Business Podcast. I, again, am your host, David J.P. Fisher. Nobody calls me that. Everybody calls me D. Fish or D. If you'd like to reach out and have a conversation with me, would love to chat. Easiest way to find me is right on Twitter, at D. Fish Rockstar. And by the way, if you're enjoying the show, it would really help us out a bunch if you go to iTunes or whatever platform you're listening to this on, hit the subscribe button so you get all the shows right away. But also if you could leave us a review, leave us a 5-star rating. One, it makes me feel good, right? And there's nothing wrong with patting my ego a little bit. But more than anything, it actually helps us be found by more people. So if you do like what we're doing, that would really mean the world to us. And I really appreciate that. And of course, my guest today is my good friend, Rebecca Burnick. Rebecca is the founder, and as she says, the big head of Office Heads. They provide financial management and strategic coaching to small staffed creative and professional service firms. She does lots of cool things, which you're just about to find out about. But Rebecca, how can people get in touch with you? How can they find out more?
The easiest way to get a hold of me is going to our website, www.officeheads.com. You can read up about what we do. I have an ebook online that talks about how we do it. And there's a contact me form where it goes directly into my inbox and I will respond nearly immediately. You can also give us a call at 847-866-8877.
And if you haven't figured it out by now, Rebecca is awesome and super down to earth. And a world record holder. Share, dish.
Okay, I race vintage motorcycles. And not only do I race vintage motorcycles, I road race and I land speed race. I have yet to stand on the podium in my road racing because I'm not that fast on the Kirby track, but I have dragged a knee. But I hold a number of records on a vintage production motorcycle, both on asphalt in North Carolina and in Ohio. But most exciting is I hold records at the Bonneville Salt Flats in Utah.
That is awesome. How many records do you have right now? Do you know?
Oh, shoot. Seven? Maybe seven? I don't know.
So one wasn't enough. Let's just go for an easy round seven.
Well, you know, once you get the tape, it's the adrenaline is amazing. And then you go, let me go faster. Let me do it again. Let me try something else. It's very, very, very exciting.
So what's, and I think it is important to say that this is, as you noted, the vintage kind of classification. So it's not like you're on the fastest motorcycle ever going 200 miles per hour. But you still go pretty fast. What's the fastest that you've gone on these motorcycles? And what year was that motorcycle from?
Ooh, okay, so it's both good news and bad news on the fastest I've ever gone. I was at the Bonneville Soft Flats. I was in a 19, I can't remember the year of it. It's a Moto Morini Dart 350. I think it's a 98.
Okay.
I could be wrong on that one, sorry. But I went 99.97 on the Soft Flats. And so the way that the Bonneville Soft Flats work is you go down one way, and if you qualify in your class, then you get to go the opposite way. And if, because, you know, wind and various different things that get in the way or help you. So if then they take both and they combine the average, and if that breaks the record, it does. So on this particular motorcycle, it was so close to 100. Like, I'm going to get this. I'm going to beat 100 on this motorcycle. And it was the rain came in, as it often does at the salt flats, and just downpoured and filled up the track, and it became pretty much a lake, and the meet was canceled. So I didn't even get to do my return run.
But 99 miles per hour.
99.97.
Sorry.
Almost 100.
99.97 on a 20-year-old motorcycle. I don't even know how to respond to that, because that's a whole level of excitement that, to be blunt, I don't want to experience. How did you get into this? That's what I want to know. How did you get into this? I don't think I've ever asked.
Oh, gosh. I got into everything two-wheeled. I got into because of peer pressure. And it wasn't even peer pressure. This is also a blessing and a curse for me, where someone will say something, hey, have you ever done this? I'm like, I don't know, sure. And I'm so open to new experiences. So it allows me, I have so many wonderful and colorful stories of my life, but this was one of them where...
Remember, it's a family show, or, you know, at least we have to get the non-swearing rating on iTunes. So
I'll keep it clean. Most of them I can keep clean. So I bought a scooter, and then someone said, hey, you should get a motorcycle. I went, okay. And I think that motorcycles, the more you can see through them, the more beautiful that they are. So I ended up just... by default, getting a 1975 Honda 360T or something. And then I ran into a bunch of people who love these vintage motorcycles. And they taught me how to, and I started to wrench on it. And they taught me how to ride better in the streets. I got on the track. And then someone said, hey, you should race. Like, okay. So I started to road race. And then someone said, hey, have you ever thought about land speed racing? No, what does that mean? Boom. And before you know it, I was land speed racing. So most of this comes from people just saying, you know, you should do this. I'm like, oh, I don't know any better. My mom told me that I could do anything I wanted and nothing could hold me back. And I, you know, so I say, okay.
Well, apparently the only thing that can hold you back is a rainstorm on the Bonneville Salt Flats. But so nature still wins.
Yes. Well, you know, yes.
That is awesome.
Well, and you know, you, like you said, that I'm not going the fastest because these bikes are old. The most fun I had, and when when I started land speed racing, I was riding a production 1954 BMW R25/3. That means production means this bike is as if it rolled off the showroom floor in 1954. That motorcycle was built to go 60 max. It was also built as a family mobile, where you put a sidecar on it, you put all the family in, you drive around town. It has not a lot of shocks to it, so it's a rather bumpy ride. But that particular motorcycle, which is actually on display in my office with some of my awards, my records on top of it, I went 81 miles per hour on the asphalt, and I want to say 77 point something on the salt. Which is a pretty, so it's not, you know, I've gone faster than that on Lakeshore Drive. Don't tell anybody. But that particular bike, when you land speed race, it's about the bike and not really about the rider.
Okay. That's awesome. Again, I am just going to appreciate that and say I would never like to take a ride with you. I mean,
I'm very responsible. That's on the track. That's why you get on the track. So you can be fast on the track, but responsible while you're commuting.
You know, it has nothing to do with your responsibility. I just have way too high of an estimation of my, the worth of all my limbs being where they are. And I'm going to keep them there. I can be a fraidy cat at times, and that's fine. Yeah. Emotional risks, no problem. Physical, I'm good. All right. So I also wanted to ask you this too, because again, we can keep talking motorcycles forever. So you are one of my good friends here in Evanston. You live close to me. We actually had Caesar Marone on the podcast before, who runs Sketchbook Brewing, which I know happens to be like out your back door. So my question is, what's your favorite sketchbook beer right now?
I would say Orange Door. They also have a brown ale. It changes. Orange Door is really good. I'm kind of a Pilsner person, so I usually will go to that one, but I'll drink them. Unless I feel like I need my beer to be a meal, and then I'll go with one of their chewier beers, but usually Orange Door.
Okay. I don't think I've had anybody on the show yet who said that Pilsner is their go-to.
I don't know. You know, maybe I like quantity over quality. If the beer is too heavy, I can't drink a lot. So, you can find like a pilsner that has a good flavor that's just not too heavy, and then you can sit and chit chat with people over hours. We've done that before, haven't we?
Well, no, maybe once or four times. I don't know. Summertime in Chicago, that's what it's for. What's your favorite pilsner? Do you have one, or is it just...
Oh, gosh, you know, shame on me. No, I actually, there's so many beers and so many choices out there, and I am not a connoisseur. I'll just go up and then I'll say, I don't know, I don't want anything that's too twingy, which means it's not an IPA. And then they'll go, I don't know. And so then I taste a bunch of them and then I drink. I will say I have a beer experience. It's one of my favorite beer experiences when I first started drinking when I was very young. I grew up in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and I had a friend of mine, who was the, do they call him beer master, brewmaster?
Brewmaster, yeah.
The brewmaster at Summit Brewery the year they opened.
Okay.
So they were in St. Paul across the river. And I remember, because I have colorful stories, it was about the time when I was a private investigator. So I was on my way to whoever I was, you know, watching. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to go visit Earl over at the brewery. And it was 8 o'clock in the morning and I just knocked on the door and he let me in. They had the beautiful, you know, brass things. Shame on me. And I walked in and he said, do you want a taste? And he just gave me just a finger of beer at 8 a.m. that was so fresh. And I just went, wow, this has got to be the best thing I've ever had. So Summit was my favorite beer for a very, very, very long time. But now I get to walk across my alley and drink fresh beer all the time.
So I'm sensing a pattern. There's always, you always have to know somebody in a brewery.
Yes.
Let's be honest. I have a lot of friends who run breweries right now, so they're good friends to have.
They are. Now, Caesar has not let me in at 8 a.m. to sip off the kegs, but, you know, maybe someday I can expect when I knock on the door, just give me a little bit.
Well, I'm just saying, maybe one of these days, me and you will go over there, you know, we'll knock on the door. Yeah.
Sounds like a plan.
I love it. And you know what? Before we go into any more other crazy stories, private investigator, world record holder, helper of small businesses, you do it all. But as I ask every guest before we wrap up, if you could give someone a tip to make today a little bit better, what would it be?
It would be to find your passion and then figure out how to make money doing it. Because then every day is a lot of fun.
Perfect. Rebecca, thank you so much for joining me today.
It was my pleasure.
As always, thanks for stopping by. You can find show notes and links to the topics in this episode at beerbeatsandbusiness.com. You can also share this episode through social media and leave reviews through iTunes, Stitcher, or any of your favorite podcasting services. This episode, like all others, is brought to you by our regulars over at Patreon. If you'd like to be one of the people with your own spot at the bar, we'd love to have you. Visit patreon.com/B3 and become a regular today. Want to get in on the conversation? Easy. Send DFish a message on Twitter at DFishRockstar and we'll save a spot for you at the bar for the next Beer, Beats, and Business.
It was about the time when I was a private investigator. And I was on my way to my...
Wait, hold on a second. I just want to be able to laugh without interrupting you.